You're listening to Air Schooner, listening that moves you.
Welcome to episode 2. She's Shauna Durham.
And he's Scott Winter. Today we're talking about writers who write about work.
Writing about work was the theme of a fusion project between Prairie Schooner and the Cordite web magazine in Australia. It appears online at the Prairie Schooner's website. And it's full of some great writing. But what was really interesting was some of the odd jobs some of these writers have listed in their bios. Because I think back on my jobs, and I had some pretty awful ones.
Oh, yeah. My worst job would have to be a summer nanny position I took after high school. I thought hanging out in a mansion on Long Island would be pretty great, but it didn't turn out like I expected. Aside from picking up after their fancy little dog, I had a 8-year-old boy tell me that he pretty much didn't have to follow any of my directions because I don't have to do that because I'm rich.
These writers had a lot of awful jobs too, like R.F. McEwen, shined shoes, ran booze in a pool hall, caddied for golfers, endured the night shift at a steel mill, and taught middle school.
Steel mill or middle school, which one's tougher?
I'll take the steel mill.
Marcella Pixley is still an 8th grade middle school teacher.
John Kennedy tutored for the royal family of Jordan. I bet they had somebody who said they were too rich to do that assignment.
Yeah. Gary Finke stood on a Heinz company production line.
Linda McCarriston was a lunch counter girl.
Danny Ramine Powell sold pot holders door to door as a 10-year-old.
Roy Scheel packed peaches in Arkansas and cleaned chocolate vats at Russell Stover.
Floyd Skloot apprenticed for a butcher, analyzed public policy, and attended to a parking lot.
Anders Munson, he's got to be our winner, don't you think?
Oh, I think so. He was the king of the crappy jobs.
Yeah, he janitored at a state park, survived Shopko for one day, cashiered at Walmart, lifted heavy things at a Frito-Lay potato chip warehouse, and he admits to shoplifting.
I don't think you can call shoplifting a job.
Another one of the writers we haven't talked about yet is Marvin Bell.
Bell was, among other things, a 5 and 10 stock boy, a clerk, a cashier, worked at a law library, and was a U.S. Army Foreign Military Training Officer.
And our research assistant, Bob Fugley, caught up with Bell and talked to him about the Dead Man Poems.
Marvin Bell is a former Iowa Poet Laureate and a retired longtime teacher at the Iowa Writers Workshop, here to talk to us a bit about work and writing and the Dead Man series of poems. Would you like to say something about the series as a whole?
Yeah, I think it was the winter of 1986-87. I was in Port Townsend, Washington at that time, and I wrote a poem that sounded, it sounded like one of those old wisdom books lost to antiquity. The Tibetan Book of the Dead, or the Egyptian Book of the Dead, something that had just somehow come to me. And there were some other very strange things about it. So I called it From the Book of the Dead Man, and it went into a book of poetry called Iris of Creation in 1990. I didn't actually write another one like that until 1994. My wife, Dorothy, said, you should write more of these, but I never take good advice until years later. But eventually I did write a lot of them and published a book called The Book of the Dead Man in 94. Then I published another book of Dead Man poems in 1997. And then a few showed up in books published after that, but not until now was there another book of all Dead Man poems, this latest book called Vertigo, The Living Dead Man Poems.
All right, well, why don't you go ahead and read the poem, The Book of the Dead Man, Wartime, for us.
Sure. The dead man, dead and alive at the same time, joins up. Being both dead and alive, the dead man has nothing to lose. The corpses that were kept out of sight of the president turn up in the newspapers under their red, white, and blue blankets. The unregistered suicides at the front skew the casualty figures. The number one adds up, the tens, the hundreds, and thousands, and hundreds of thousands. He cannot find enough wheelbarrows for the innards. His spade is blunted from the digging. The dead man is not loyal to America, but to Americans. The dead man was Lincoln's nightmare. The dead man was a good combatant. He obeyed the orders that took place in the dark. He ran the straw dummy through with a polished bayonet. His insignia shone. When he tore off his gas mask, he said, "Yes, sir," through his tears. In the barracks, he was orderly, pristine. For it was military to be headlong, then obeisant, It was martial to be in step, then scattershot behind fields of fire. His is the timeless courage of the eternal football player, persuaded that the team can do more if it just wants to. He is the lie embodied, the youthful will, the life force beheaded. Okay, then, when there is no weaponry sufficient, no final map, no total casualty, no last report, no one uniform, no happenstance that is not as deadly as the tracers, then there is no end to it. The dead man volunteers. He is needed.
Prairie Schooner launches the winter 2011 Irish issue at the Sheldon Museum of Art, February 9th and 10th. From 1 to 5 p.m. each day, see Irish writers Sandra Bunting, Nuala Ní Chróir, Aidan Rooney, and Deany Rowan Blanc read and give on-stage interviews. Festivities continue Friday night at 7 p.m. with an hour-long reception, including live Irish music and Irish-themed food and drinks, followed by readings from the award-winning Irish authors.
Prairie Schooner, a national literary quarterly published with the support of the English Department at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and the University of Nebraska Press, is home to the best fiction, poetry, essays, and reviews being published today by beginning, mid-career, and established writers.
Toy Derricotte's fifth and most recent book is The Undertaker's Daughter from the University of Pittsburgh Press. She's won tons of awards and serves on various boards for foundations. She's worked many childhood jobs in Detroit, which she talks about with Bob Fugli, who caught up with her while she was traveling across the U.S. for readings.
Welcome, Toy.
Thank you, Bob.
The poem that you'll be reading for us is titled On the Reasons I Loved Telly the Fish. Is there a sort of unifying theme or idea for the collection as a whole that you'd like to say a bit about?
The book is called The Undertaker's Daughter. I am an undertaker's daughter and granddaughter. But the book is about the undertaking of the creative act and how this process of creating changes the creator's relationship with his or her subject. And in my case, the subject was my past. And especially the abusive relationship that that I had with my father, and so in undertaking this book and through that process, the book comes to a very different place at the end than it begins.
So your father was in fact an undertaker.
That's right.
Okay.
And my grandfather.
Ah, I see. But not you.
No. I think I am. I think what I've understood about my work over a long period of time is I am going underground, and I am very much about burying and unburying.
Sure.
What my project over this period of 40 years. On the Reasons I Loved Telly the Fish. Why would I say I was pathetic when talking about my life? Why would I think of it as little? My little life, I said, as if looking back at what kept me alive, what I constructed to make my own success, to regard that with tenderness and understanding as something even sweet and marvelous, was insane. Then maybe I began to love Telly. Really nothing in the grand scheme of things. The way that lady, when I told her that I paid $100 a month for someone to come in and feed Telly when I was away, said, "But Toy, how much did Telly cost? $1.98? Well then, why not just flush him every time and get another?" Whatever I said to myself, whatever I felt and did, that kind of care was silly. Nice, but, crazy. The way when you grow up and understand the great things, a fish's life is nothing. as if, and probably they can't think or feel. There are much more important things to do, to think about, to love, to dedicate ourselves to. There are doctors, great poets. There's fine furniture, true love, children, God for God's sake. There's everything to remember, everything to be worried and concerned about. As if I could find it, if I just kept looking, something really real out there, just outside of what I could take in. And this was how I stayed alive. My aunt took me to her job from the time I was about 3. I'd go down to the basement where she was head of the mail department, first black woman to have such an executive job in Detroit, even though it was in the basement. I'd take up a little desk in the corner and do whatever she said, open the flaps of envelopes by the box, 500 in a box, maybe 20 boxes a day for 10 cents a box, and with each box, I'd compete with myself each day to make more money and make enough to buy my own lunch, a corned beef sandwich at the Broadway Market with 2 halves of a new dill and a fruit punch, and sit there at the marble counter enjoying the warmth of meat, the slop of mustard, and the way the rind of the bread was just a little tough to tear with your teeth. I worked without word away from the grown-ups, able to make my own way and feel competent, as if I had a place in something I could truly do without making somebody mad or unhappy. And just looking back on myself as if I were an eye looking from a high place, seeing that little girl counting the envelopes, boxes, making her fingers go faster, counting the boxes over and over because she'd forget and had to make certain. When I look back on that little 5-year-old, 6, 7, 8, 9, it was as if I were a little busy fish being watched by an interested and even caring owner.
The theme of our podcast today is work and writing, and that poem is a wonderful example of the use of the concrete details of a job like that and the kind of significance that they had for you. Writing, of course, is a great deal of work, as all writers know.
Yeah.
We are curious to hear about any other jobs that you may have had that might have fed into your writing in any way. What is the worst job you've ever had?
Oh, God. I guess I didn't like particularly handling eggs. My father had an egg business, and you would pull the eggs up to a light to make sure they were okay. I didn't like that. It was cold. You had to be in a cold place.
For complete interviews by Bob Fugle of Toy Derricotte and Marvin Bell, please go to prairieschooner.unl.edu. And join us in 2 weeks when we bring you the highlights from the Sheldon Gallery release party for Prairie Schooner's Winter 2011 Irish issue.
Prairie Schooner is going to AWP in Chicago. On Thursday, March the 1st, see Shane Book, Cara Candito, James Cruz, Greg Herbert, and Marie L'Espérance read for Prairie Schooner's 10th Anniversary Book Prize Series reading. On Friday, March the 2nd, Book, Candito, and L'Espérance will sign books. Later that day, hear Glenn Alusha contribute to the panel on the new management, the literary journal in a changing world.
Air Schooner is a biweekly product of Prairie Schooner and produced with research support from Robert Fugle, Ted Wheeler, and Marion Kunkel. Production assistants are Catherine Larson and Franny Sprawls. Technical support comes from Rick Alloway and Jerry Renault in the College of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Air Schooner is produced by Scott Winter and the brainchild of Prairie Schooner editor Kwame Dawes.